Some, perhaps many, network engineers seek to be managers. The idea is that control over the technical situation would lead to a better network, and so, if you want the network to be made in your image, then you should run the show. Maybe that's your story. Maybe you're later in your career and your reasons for wanting to be a manager are a little different, but whatever your situation, I can tell you from experience that taking on a management role is a complex decision, and the role is probably not what you think it is if you've never done it before. Well, who am I? I am Ethan Banks, your frequent Packet Pushers host and tech writer, and with me is the wonderful Greg Farrell, along with many-time Packet Pushers guest, Amy Arnold. Amy and I have known each other in that internet-friendly way for many years now, and she agreed to come on the show to swap notes with me and Greg about our experiences as technically-minded IT managers. Amy, welcome to Packet Pushers, and please introduce your Texas self to the audience.
Hello, I am a senior network engineer in the public sector. I have been a network engineer for quite some time now. A few years ago, I started managing a small network team, and my role is really a hybrid of technical lead and formal manager. I am here today to kind of talk about my experiences with you guys, compare some notes.
You know, and I have to tell you, people that are listening, Amy is a prepper. So whenever we do the shows, we have an outline that we build ahead of time. It goes into Google Docs and we share it with everybody. We can all collaborate so that we all know what we're going to talk about before we record. I have never seen so much copy pre-written for a show in my life. Amy is awesome. She pre-answered all the questions. So I'm going to do my best to steer her left.
Thank you. Thank you. I am constant prepper. Yes, you have nailed it. Exactly.
Greg, have you done management stuff in your career too?
In various forms. I've been a team leader, but I've always avoided the concept of managing, firmly staying in the technical field. I've sort of put my feet there, but I have done team leadership, if that's sort of in that space.
Yeah, I've kind of been the same. I've made the formal mistake a few times. I was a technical services manager for a small VAR, which I had like six engineers answering to me, get out there and bill time, go, bill now. And network operations manager for state government. That was a huge mistake. It's like the people I worked for were like, you sure you want to do this? Because you're totally an engineer. And why do you think you want to be a manager? And I did it anyway. And then I was really sorry.
I guess there's a technical leadership is I had responsibility for a team of flexed a bit between 5 and 10 engineers at any given time. And I was the lead person. And basically, I was the poop scoop, I called it. Mm-hmm. I'll go around cleaning up the mess that the other engineers left behind. And because I was the senior engineer, they were like my little flock. So I was sort of responsible for them as human beings. But there was a manager who was responsible for the budget and the reviews and stuff like that. Let's say he was a fool, an outright idiot, actually, to be fair. And the executives knew it. And that's why they put me in charge of the team, technically. But he had responsibility. I think the difference between technical leadership and management is when a manager actually gets to own the budget.
Yes.
For that team and does the interviews and the HR reports, all the things that I regard as secretarial work.
Yep. And I got stuck with that working for a big bank where I took on the network architecture manager role and I had all the technical stuff to do, but I also got all of that secretarial work as you described it as well. Oh, it was a joy. It was truly a joy.
Sex appeal of a road accident.
So, Amy, question for you. In your experience of being a manager, do you think that being a manager gives you control over the network's technical direction?
I think that it can. For me, it definitely does. I have control over which vendors, which solutions, which projects, how they're designed and implemented. I have a lot of control. I mean, I still do have to have a budget, and there are still layer type 8 type issues that I have to deal with. I don't get everything I ask or wish for. But the technical direction, I do lead that. I actually, though, kind of led that before I was manager. So I'm not sure that that came with my management responsibilities. I think that traditionally, yeah, if you are the manager of the team, a lot of times you do have that technical direction.
But what if you wanted to go weird? Like, let's say you've been a Cisco shop for 15 years and you're like, man, Dell's got some awesome stuff or HP is really looking good for this. Do you think you'd have the license to go off and do that?
I do, but with caveats, right? Okay. So I can't just come in and say, you know what, there is this fly-by-night vendor and I think they're awesome and they're giving us this great discount. Let's do it. No, it's not like that. I have to come in. I can make my case. I have to know my stuff, a lot of research, a lot of here's the cost comparison. It's not always about money, but let's face it, a lot of times it is money. And I come in with, here's what I think we're doing. Here's the direction. Here's the long-term type outlook. Here's why I think this is a good idea. I could still get overridden, though. there's a lot of momentum. A lot of places have a lot of momentum and a certain brand name. And we're no different. But no, absolutely. If I come in and say, you know what, here's what's going wrong with this. Here's why I think we need this. Here's the risk that we're taking. I'm taken very seriously. And I can actually overcome some of that momentum.
Well, you're highlighting the experience that I had too, but from a different standpoint. Now, I had some managerial roles when I was pretty young, like in my late 20s, early 30s. And I kind of thought like, well, we do whatever the best thing is. But then you said, yeah, but you got to cost justify and all the rest. And sometimes the best answer, the most technically pure, that thing that gives you the beautiful, wonderful network you've always imagined isn't what they're going to buy because you can't actually afford that thing a lot of times. Yeah, you have, you know, they respect your decision and what you're recommending, but it's got to be within the bounds of that budget for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And they get really concerned because I'm public sector, so I'm spending other people's money. And they get a little concerned about that, right? They want to make sure that we're spending it and we're spending it well and making the good choices. So yeah, you're right. I can't buy necessarily the gold standard, but I'm also not buying the cheap just to save a few bucks now kind of standard. It's about getting the most functionality at a cost that is reasonable, I guess, for lack of a better phrase.
Oh man, you have to deal with RFPs, don't you?
I have had to deal with RFPs. Absolutely. They're a lot of fun. A real joy to be had.
I've worked in public sector as well, state government, and yeah, I'm getting the screaming heebie-jeebies just thinking about RFPs, especially RFPs that were constructed so that only one particular vendor could win. I don't know if you've ever been in that situation, but...
I try not to be in that situation, actually.
Because we're going to phrase this in a particular way so that Bob's the only bidder that could possibly get this thing.
Exactly. I understand the sentiment because when you do have to go out and get multiple quotes, there are always people who want to bid on your stuff that you're like, oh, please no. Please no.
Exactly.
But if you write it to one vendor, though, then that vendor is like, well, I'm a shoe-in, right? Why am I going to give you an aggressive deal? And, you know, you already have my bid.
It's a terrible way to game the system. But as you said, there are certain people you definitely don't want to qualify for that RFP because you don't want to do business with them. Oh, no, Bob's House of Networks just got the bid because they were so cheap. And they're also awful, and I hate them so much.
Bob's House of Networks.
Whatever. You know what I'm saying.
Well, there's this thing in public sector now that I think is more common than it once used to be, and it's called, like, best value. So I don't necessarily have to go with lowest cost. I go with best value. And sometimes there's a little flexibility in that.
Mm. For some definition of the word value.
Yes, exactly. You can see.
So, Amy, change of subject here. Something I've struggled with is delegation. So I'm curious to know, is it hard for you to delegate?
You know, it's really not now. But when I first started, I was really terrible at it, actually, because I had this view that you had to give away an assignment entirely and be completely hands-off or you're not delegating. That was a real disaster as far as I'd give someone an assignment that they were bad at deadlines and I'd give them a time-sensitive assignment and take a hands-off approach. That was just complete recipe for failure for them and for me. So I've come to find that delegation is more of like a sliding scale. So you assess whether or not an employee's ready, and then that kind of tailors what involvement you put into that project, whether you're going to be very active in the mentoring, or maybe they just check in every once in a while. So I don't know. Have you guys had a similar experience?
For me, delegation was always pressure to deliver something. And so for me, as more of a controlling kind of person by nature, you know, fearful that if I don't handle it, some little thing's going to go wrong. It's not going to be done the way I would have done it. I would struggle with the delegation there, saying, you know, I'm going to get in trouble if this thing isn't done right. So I got to hang on to it, which as a manager, you can't do because you don't scale that way. You absolutely can't do that. And so very quickly I learned, you know, I must delegate. And then, you know, what is the best approach? I got into, like you described, it would be, I would delegate, but I would check in regularly and stay in touch and make sure, do you need help? Is everything going okay? How are we looking with the deadline? Keeping some involvement rather than just, you know, that meme where the girl standing in front of the burning building, it worked in dev, you know, ops problem now. You can't delegate that way because it just goes up in flames and that's not good. So yeah, I had to learn all of that. But my biggest struggle early on was just delegating at all though, because it was just trusting other people to do something when you're so used to you yourself doing it was really hard for me early on.
It always kind of reminded me of high school group projects where you know you're going to end up doing all the work anyways. So Why would you delegate at all?
Right. So but you have to make an effort to be seen to be making a team or you won't get any marks.
Exactly. Yeah. And your team knows if you're holding back because you don't think they'll do as good a job as you do. And they're just going to resent you for it. So they really are.
I think it's funny. Everything we needed to know about being an adult, we learned in kindergarten. Yes. You've got to let everybody play with the toys.
Yes, you do.
Everybody has to have a go, but you have to do what the teacher says.
Exactly.
I would way rather participate in individual sports than team sports any day, though. I am just not that guy. Oh, man.
The worst part is when you delegate to somebody and you know that statistically there's a significant chance that this is going to go to poop and you're going to be getting a shovel out to dig your way back into the problem.
That is exactly where I had to come to this whole sliding scale type of involvement was, you know what, I know their weaknesses and how can I help them with that? Instead of just going, okay, it's all going to go to crap and I have to clean it up. It's sort of a, okay, how can I do this without being a micromanager? Nobody likes the micromanager, right? So like employees that would miss deadlines. Instead, when we have this project, I would say, okay, I want you to send me the time scale, send me the project plan, pick some dates on calendars before we start so that we can talk about it and review it. And so they're the ones generating that schedule, not me. So it's a little less micromanaging and more just checking in, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Micromanaging is, you see those in the Dilbert strips. Move the mouse, move it, click now. And then again, that's a scaling problem. If you micromanage as a manager, you're so involved in what everyone working for you is doing, you don't have time to actually do your job effectively because you're micromanaging. And it just, it doesn't work. It's not really what you're there for. You got to find that balance. Well, Amy, how much of the job of managing, would you say, how much of the job is managing humans and how much of it is technical leadership?
In my role, which I really love my role, most of my job is technical leadership. I spend most of my days designing, fleshing out projects, mentoring. We're small enough that we're all doing the technical work. It's mostly technical leadership. But there are employee issues. And when they come up, they are usually urgent. And they can be these huge time sinks. Whereas you can like reboot a server or a switch or something and fix it. Human beings are a little harder to deal with. You can't just wait till a maintenance window to patch them. They come to your office and their problems can't be ignored. They are there and you have to deal with them.
Now, what sort of problems are we talking about? I mean, obviously you can't get specific, but you know, are we talking about people come to you with issues or you have a discipline issue that you need to deal with?
I think without getting too specific, because I don't want to, you know, rat out anybody, I've had the whole gamut. So sometimes you've got an employee that has personal problems at home. Sometimes you've got employees that are having problems with their workload and with getting things done. Sometimes you have employees having problems with other employees. Those are always fun to deal with, but it's the whole gamut. You get better at reading people and you can kind of see some of the storms brewing and hopefully deal with that before it becomes a problem. But sometimes they just show up and here they are and you have to deal with them.
And as you said, they're a time sink. I remember a number of issues that maybe I was a manager in the role and maybe I wasn't, but I would get pulled into these things where you're sitting across from a manager explaining a thing that happened and so on. Or, could you pull the web records for Bob? I'm going to put Bob on the table again. And I need a report of everywhere Bob's been going. It's like, oh gosh, there's an investigation. They're trying to fire Bob and I'm the guy that's going to help make that happen. I feel like crap. And yes, it's an enormous amount of time that gets pulled in. And then, you know, people do come to you and have the personal issues are the worst because you've got a job to do. They've got a job to do. And you're trying to accommodate their personal situation through that, which is always difficult. People going through divorces, people that have dealt with people with an alcohol challenge, people who lost their license due to some legal issue and couldn't get to work reliably. All kinds of stuff like that can happen and things you never thought about. Crap, how am I going to deal with this?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Whereas you can like Google an error message and look it up and have about 10 different suggestions on how to fix this, people are a little bit different. The error messages are not quite so clear, and the workarounds are a little tough.
I will go back to your initial point, though. My experience was the same as yours, that it was mostly technical leadership that was really required. The human stuff did come up, and it was annoying. Well, annoying was challenging when it did. So annoying is not quite the right word. If you're not down with it, if you're not up for it,
yeah,
you don't want to be a manager because they are there. But yeah, it was more technical leadership and providing that guidance and direction as opposed to dealing with the human stuff. So
I think one of the challenges I face too is I still do so much of the technical that when management stuff comes up, I didn't really budget that. You can tell I'm a prepper, right? You mentioned me prepping for the show.
Yep.
I'm a prepper. I've got my days planned out. So when they show up unexpectedly at your, you know, office door, it's like, well, how am I going to fit this in, right? What am I going to do now? I think that happens quite often.
You need the calendar slush fund, Amy.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I don't have one of those.
Hi, everybody. We'll get back to the podcast in just a minute, but I want to thank today's sponsor, ThousandEyes. As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, visibility diminishes, which is a huge problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services. That's where ThousandEyes comes in. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. Your corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider network, all from one place. Cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. Together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. With ThousandEyes, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems, such as device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, and more. You can share data and insights with vendors and customers to resolve problems faster. And here's a special offer just for listeners. Sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, it's network intelligence you can see. And now back to the podcast.
Greg, you had mentioned earlier budget issues. In other words, how much authority you really have is tied back to money and finances. So in your different roles, you had a lot of technical leadership. Did you also get involved with money and budget and signing authority, that sort of thing?
In different aspects. So there's signing authority for spending money for purchase orders and things like that. And quite often I would be that person. But when it came to project budgets, so a lot of money was allocated through project budgets, and then the project managers were the people who had to sign off. But they would only do the actual signing off on whatever I had committed to. So, you know, if this was the project and this was the bill of materials, I would design the bill of materials and say, sign that off. And they'd go, okay, like a project manager knows what a bill of materials of Cisco components looks like. But the other one where I've also been contributing to is how much do we pay staff and how many staff do we need? And how do we allocate tasks between the team? So if we have a team of 4 or 6 or 8 people doing the networking, how do we say, you know, you're the firewall person? Or do we say, you're a specialist in the firewall, but here's your second, you have to retrain to be the backup. So if so-and-so is not around, you're the firewall person. And that type of stuff. And then that leads into how much do we pay you? Now, I've never been responsible for actually paying people and doing the negotiations for that. Again, that's just secretarial work for me. I would much rather be, you know, reading up on a technology manual. And I've always been able to convince management that if I did all the other stuff and all they had to do was the secretarial work, they thought that they were doing the important stuff. So it kind of worked out. I didn't have to do any of the paperwork or take any of the responsibility. But I ended up with sort of saying, you know, end up in discussion several, you know, this has happened 4 or 5 times in my career. You know, this person's asking for a pay rise. Should we give it to them? And I'd talk through, you know, and blah, 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 and pretty much end up helping to, you know, either making the decision or contributing it to it substantially.
What about you, Amy? In your role, do you have a budget and signing authority, that kind of stuff?
So I'm very much in an industry where it's a lot of project funding, like Greg was talking about. I don't necessarily determine which projects a department's going to take on as far as what they want to do. But as far as spending the money that's allocated to the networking pieces of it, I have a lot of discretion. Typically, I'll even have some influence in how much is allocated to the networking pieces of it if we planned well. So hopefully, you know, they come and say, we want to do this. I say, well, it's going to cost you this much. And they give me hopefully that amount of money to do it. And that's usually how the projects work. So typically, I can have a lot of discretion about how I want to handle the networking pieces of a solution. Sometimes I don't have that much ability to determine solutions. Sometimes it's, hey, we're going with this thing and I want this thing to work. But what Greg was talking about as far as people and headcount, I don't have quite that much influence on that. Those things are decided, those kind of recurring expenses like employees, I don't have a whole lot of influence. I imagine that if I said I needed someone else, that I could have a lot of influence in that discussion and moving that along, but I don't get to decide, hey, I need one more person, let's hire him. I don't have that kind of authority.
Now, Amy, when you're building a network project and you're specifying all the parts, do you include training for your staff?
You know, I am actually, I don't on projects unless I can work it in, but I do have a training budget. That's quite nice. So
that's cool. It's the reason I asked that is, you know, I asked it the way I did is that was always the thing that got chopped from the project. You know, we didn't have a training budget, whatever it was. And so you try to work in training into the cost of an overall project since we didn't have a training budget. Yeah, you try to work it in there and then it gets inevitably cut. It was just always so depressing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we do exactly what you tried to do. We try to get it into the project if we can. Absolutely. Because training dollars only go so far.
Or then work the strategy of, well, can we adjust the price of this other item so you can give me a $0 cost Cisco learning credits or something?
Yes.
Like that. Yeah,
play exactly. That game.
Ah, terrible, terrible.
It is very difficult for an IT team to decide where the funds go. Like, how much relevance does a network have compared to storage and compute and operating systems and desktops and applications and developers and things like that? Just as often, I've been the only networking person in a team and responsible for everything. They don't have any other networking people. And that it is actually nice to be in a team of people. And when you're the only networking person, it actually gets incredibly lonely because there's no one to back you up. Every decision you make or technology or everything that you do, you're the only person who's going to be able to make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been in those situations before. And it is actually, that's why packet pushers, to plug packet pushers, is so awesome. You are relaying that experience to other people because there's still a lot of people out there who are the only network engineer on their team. And they have no idea what if they're doing the right things or the wrong things. It's nice to know what somebody else is doing and what their experiences are.
The Packet Pushers Podcast, giving hugs to network engineers for 6 years.
Exactly.
One of the things I hope people do get from this is that everybody's actually got the same problems, is that we all share the same pain and we all, by and large, have the same problems because we all use the same technology and we all use it in the same way. Now, I know lots of people run around. And one of the things I've been riding my unicorn around is this precious snowflake. But do you know what? If you can take your skills from one network to another, you aren't a precious snowflake. Right? You know, you really aren't. If you're a person that designs rockets for NASA, you haven't got job portability. You are a precious snowflake. If I can walk out of Merchant Bank in the center of London and arrive next week at a carrier in rural England, that's not special snowflakes. That's just something else entirely.
Special, just like everybody else.
Yes.
Exactly.
That's right. Let me take a minute to think how much I care about you. No, too long.
So, Amy, since you've been on both sides of the equation, you've been an engineer and you've also been a manager. Can you compare the two? I mean, if you put it this way, compared to being an engineer, what did you like the most about being a manager and what did you dislike?
Well, one of the things I like most about being a manager, they're very similar to what I like about being an engineer. I like mentoring other people and I like organizing. Obviously, I'm a prepper. I like watching a team execute a plan. I like problem solving. And I found that that even goes for people problem solving. For me, it's like I'm debugging people and it's fascinating. I'm trying to figure out why they work the way they do, why they do what they do to be effective is actually quite a mental challenge, and that appeals to me.
So is the sparkly bat like a phase in your human debugging process?
Yes, it is. It's my the initial phase. But there are others. Yes, exactly. Well, and that actually leads me to what I dislike, and I can't apply the sparkly bat, but it the confrontation of being a manager, you eventually do have to confront employees. Eventually, employees will do things that they should not do or need to be counseled, or there is some kind of confrontation. And I am such an introvert, and I break out in a cold sweat at the thought of confrontation. So it is not my favorite part of the job.
Oh, I'm with you.
Not at all.
Hey, come here in this room with a closed door that everyone knows we're in the closed door because mostly we live in cubicles. And sit down and have a private conversation, and I'm going to tell you how much you suck. Yeah, who wants to have that conversation, especially if you're of an introverted mindset where confrontation is just not your thing? I am exactly with you in that. And I hired a guy who, by his credentials and references, should have been knocking it out of the park. This guy was certified to the nines, lots of project experience, former boss, coworker, whatever it was that I'd call, loved this guy, told me how great it was for me that I was going to get him to work with me. He was awful. This guy is just terrible. I'd send him out on site to do something that, according to his resume and interview, was well within his skills, and he was calling constantly looking for help to do basic and fundamental things. And it was hard for me to just, how do I get this? What am I supposed to say to this guy? You know, and I had to have that confrontation with him. The way I handled it was very early on in my career. It probably wasn't effective enough. He probably thought he was getting an attaboy or something, because I don't think I confronted so too well. Again, I would agree with you, Amy. Definitely my least favorite aspect of management is that confrontation bit, which you have to do to be effective, though, in the role. You have to.
You do. And I kind of wrap it up into the idea of mentoring someone, because that appeals to me as network engineers. I think we like to teach people how to do things and how to be better. And so if I kind of wrap that around it and think of it that way, it's a little easier because you're confronting them to help them grow, but it's still uncomfortable completely and totally.
You say you're an introvert. So have you had to change how you are, you know, like alter your social skills to be effective as a manager?
You know, I really have, actually. When you are an engineer, you don't have to make a point of have these interactions with employees. You can or you don't, but there's no pressure to generally. I mean, there's always the weird quiet guy at the office and people just leave him alone. And that's fine.
Hey,
I don't mind being
not
that
all
person.
Quiet guys are weird. Leave us alone. Stop stereotyping.
Right, exactly. But when you're
speak
a manager,
for yourself.
When you're a manager, people will interpret, especially people who aren't introverts. Oh my gosh, extroverts, the aliens among us, they interpret introverted personality traits as negative. They're like, my boss is really quiet. They must be angry. Even though you never said anything to give them that indication, they're like, they must not like me. It's like, well, no. So
I wasn't upset until you said that. Now I am.
Exactly. So now I have to be much more intentional about my social interactions with my team to keep things running smoothly, just to keep things at a, you know, things are going along. You have to be much more intentional about it.
And no, the sparkly bat's a joke. I totally wouldn't actually hit you.
Exactly. Yeah, of course not. Not while HR is watching. All right, did I say that out loud?
You did.
Not where HR can find out anyway.
Exactly. Yeah,
I always keep find it if you put a telephone book and then hit them, it doesn't leave any bruises.
So FaceTime then, Amy, is that what we're saying here?
It really is, right? You really, there, especially people who feed off of that energy and that interacting with people, they need that. And it's not wrong that they do. It's just really different.
I think the problem with extrovert people is they just don't understand that people that can be different to them. Because what is it? 20% of the population is introverted. I've seen different numbers between 20 and 30%. And dealing with extroverted people is they always assume that you should be the life of the party and have fancy cars and that reading books is for sissies or something. And most of the time you just want to sit there and just slap them, actually.
So in your case, when you're being quiet, Greg, you actually are plotting their death.
Usually. So the tweets that I send out that have got, that's usually where they come from. That's my expression.
There's passive aggressive and then there's aggressive aggressive. And I think you're the latter in your tweet world, Greg.
Yeah, that's right. You know, so when I come up with a tweet like first day of the new job, hi boss, are you mad at me yet? That's me working. You know, that sort of stuff. It's just me working through my anger.
You know, on the other hand, if you have other introverts working for you, it's not so bad. So in my most recent manager role, I had a couple of other introverts working for me. So it was fine. It was bliss. We were all quiet and to ourselves unless we had a reason to be, you know, yapping at each other, in which case we did. And it was okay. No one assumed anyone was mad. It was fine.
Yeah. Any challenge with having a team of introverts is sometimes they don't talk. And then suddenly when they do talk, it's like, whoa, too much. Do you know what I mean? It's just unlocked and these floodgates open and all this stuff comes out and you're going like, oh my God.
Well, when not in a manager role, I've had this penchant to let all these things and issues kind of build up and then I can't take it anymore. And then the long email takes you 3 hours and there's editing and you're moving paragraphs around because you've just got all the bile and vitriol and hatred and frustration that's been going on in your mind for months now. Goes out and you send it to your manager and then you realize as soon as you hit send, I totally shouldn't have sent that.
I never send it. I write that email. I've done it so many times. And then I delete it.
Really? I sent it when I was a younger man, not as an older man.
Sure.
I've composed similar emails, absolutely. Yes, just don't click the send button.
We are taking a short break from the show to talk about one of today's sponsors, Micronix Training. I can talk about Micronix not just because they are a sponsor, but because I am a Micronix customer. In fact, I have attended multiple CCIE routing and switching boot camps with Micronix over the years with instructor Narbik Kacharyans. One boot camp was just before I passed my CCI routing and switching lab back in 2008, and the most recent one was in the fall of 2015. Micronix boot camps are the real deal. You get detailed workbooks that show you not only what to do, but also the most important part of networking, verifying that what you've configured is working right. You also get live lectures from top-notch instructors. For example, Narbik's lectures are legendary among those of us that have sat in them. He wastes no words while still clearly explaining topics that might have frustrated you before. And you will not see a PowerPoint. It is all whiteboard. It's sort of like being Neo in the Matrix. You leave the lecture feeling like network foo was uploaded directly to your brain. These boot camps aren't just workbooks and lecture, though. You also get time to work on equipment configuration with even more labs designed to teach specific concepts. These boot camps are, if I'm honest, really tough, because if you do everything that's expected of you, your boot camp days will be some of the longest, but most rewarding, 5 or 10 days that you can spend. Which reminds me, Micronix offers several CCIE-level boot camps, including routing and switching, security, data center, and service provider. Some of them are 5 days, some of them are 10 days, and if you're not working on a CCIE certification, Micronix offers instruction in several other courses, including CCNA, CCNP, DCICN, CCDE, and more. So to learn from the best, head over to MicronixTraining.com. Micronix is an authorized Cisco Learning Partner, and they accept Cisco Learning Credits. One more time, that's MicronixTraining.com. And please, when you sign up for a course or a boot camp, let them know that Packet Pushers sent you. One thing we've tried to do on Packet Pushers is talk about business, try to relate the nuts and bolts and the command line that we deal with as network engineers to the fact that, hey, this affects a business. How would you say understanding business is important to you as an engineer versus as a manager?
For me, there really wasn't a difference. And maybe that's how I ended up being a manager. I don't know. But I always wanted to know why we were doing things. I wanted to know what the vision was, what the goals were, and how the business, where they were trying to get, because that really made the difference in what solutions you picked, right? I mean, there's no point in picking a solution that's not accomplishing or moving the direction they want to go. So you don't ask them, what do you want it to do? You want to say, what are you trying to accomplish, right? Doing voice deployments, I said voice, Greg, so I don't want you to freak out. But doing voice, you never ask them, what do you want this button to do? You ask them, what business's challenges are you trying to solve? How do you see the system working, not what did it used to do and can I copy that? So I'm very much about an understanding of the business is important for engineers and managers. Now, I have worked with guys and girls that they don't care. They don't want to know why. Don't bore them with why. Just tell them what they need to do. They'll code what they need to code. They'll set up what they need to set up and they don't care. So I tell my employees, though, and I try to make sure they understand the vision.
I have always loved understanding what's actually going on in the business. So if a change control that I submitted was rejected, and this was me as an engineer, I'd be like, well, why? Oh, it's end of month. What do you mean it's end of month? Well, they're closing out the books. All the final sales are coming in, you know, for this cycle. And it's really important for our reporting numbers that we don't do anything that could possibly impact that. So we feel the change control is too risky. Oh. And then it's like this light goes on and you have this insight into the business thinking that goes into why your carefully planned change control that couldn't possibly go wrong got rejected. Understand that business was really helpful as an engineer. And then as a manager, just as much. I would say for me, even more important, because I found as a manager that I was having conversations with more business people in the company as they would communicate to me what it was they were trying to get done or, you know, how what my corner of the world was fitting into in the larger project, how that was impacting the overall business and what the business was staking on the success of this project and those sorts of things. So always was a really big deal. I guess I never really understood those people that just wanted to just tell me the technical stuff I need to do because that's all I care about. Because you sticks you in that role. That's all you're ever going to do is be that person who sits in the corner of the data center with the lights off and you throw a piece of raw meat in now and again to keep the beast fed kind of person. You know, they're productive and they have a role, but they're never going to really contribute to the business in as meaningful a way as they could if they really took the time to understand what was going on.
Yeah, exactly. And you might make decisions in that if you don't know the vision, the decisions that you make, they may go completely against what they're trying to accomplish. And how would you know if you never asked and they never told you? You're like, this is an easy way to solve this problem. And you might not even think about the fact that, yeah, it might solve the problem today, but you're going to pay for that in a few years.
And business isn't complicated. It's often very simple. You pull this lever and the knob pops out at the other side. It's not rocket science how everything works. And it can often be explained in 2 or 3 minutes of thinking. And if that's not enough, then 2 or 3 minutes of talking. So it's kind of just getting that discussion and you can learn. You don't need to solve the world's problems. You just learn bits of business along the way and eventually a big picture forms up.
Very much. So, Amy, here's a kind of a big question for engineers that become managers. Did you ever feel a loss of identity or maybe credibility in a management role?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that anyone who is a manager and tells you they haven't, I would be seriously questioning them. Because I still feel awkward about being the senior engineer, much less being the manager. You look around and you're like, who put me in charge? How did this happen? There are days that you're a complete failure. But you just analyze the failure and you learn from what you've done. It's like any other job. You do something, you realize, wow, I shouldn't have done it that way. And you adjust. It's the problem solving that I mentioned earlier. You figure out what you did or shouldn't have done, and then you adjust.
So for me, there's a couple of things here. You know, one is, as an engineer, I had this identity as the guy that was going to understand how things work, really knows the intimate details of the configuration and how exactly this is going to work. And as soon as someone said, okay, we're going to need to load balance this mail application, my brain would spring into action and I would see, you know, write boxes on the whiteboard. And I knew 90% of what I needed. Being that guy that, you know, had the answers and can build an architecture on the fly and get it mostly right the first time, and then be the technical lead and stand it all up. And what's the manager do? You know, and then I look at my manager and go, they do secretarial work, like Greg said. You know, what value do they really apply? And so then being in the manager role to me sometimes meant, oh, well, I'm not, you know, the engineer guy. Maybe that's what that means. I'm kind of, you know, I've let go of some of my technical chops and I'm not going to touch the keyboard as much as I did. And so maybe I'm not all that like I thought I was once upon a time. So there was a challenge there for me at some point until I figured out what the manager really does, which it kind of goes along with all the other things you said. You never really lose the technical responsibility. You still have to lead. You still have to be a mentor. All the experience you've gleaned over the years plays a very important role in management. And whether or not you know the latest command line argument to accomplish X doesn't really have a lot to do with your, you know, technical ability and your chops necessarily. So yeah, I struggled with identity going into management roles, and I didn't at the same time once I learned more about what being in the manager role was really all about.
I think it's a growth process too. Like when you're first doing a network engineering job, right? You're like, oh, look, I remember this command set and I know exactly how to configure this and I could do this configuration in minutes. And then as you grow, it's more about design, right? And it's about architecture. Yes. And it's about all that. Well, it's sort of the same with management. I can see how you might have an identity crisis especially if all you are doing as a manager is the secretarial stuff, timesheets and all of that sort of thing, then yeah, you probably do. But really, like you said, once you're into management, you're really doing this mentoring. You're really kind of keeping them from falling into a deep, dark hole on a project because you have that leadership skills to say, no, don't do it this way. And here's why. They don't have that long-term forward-looking experience necessarily. Maybe they do, but a lot of cases they don't. You're the only one who's kind of been there, done that, and can give them a reason why from a design perspective, even if it's a people design perspective, why they shouldn't behave that way or act that way or why we should take this course of action or why we should solve a problem in this manner.
Greg, you and I both, we've baited managers along the ways of this podcast as maybe being useless or annoying or in the way, you know, these kind of things. Have you ever dealt with a manager that was actually worth something to you? And what was that person like?
I have to think back a long way, really.
Oh, man. I was hoping an example would leap to mind.
No. Well, I guess the last time I was inspired by a manager was around 15 years ago when we didn't have all of this process that IT built up. And this particular person was quite inspirational, had quite a lot of vision around where he wanted to go. And he was really able to share that with us. And he really inspired me to sort of step up my game and go somewhere. Unfortunately, after that, IT sort of got this process, you know, this is, we have to have change control. We have to do this and have to do that. And any sense of creativity or, you know, ability to change the direction, you know, this idea of direction is set, projects define scope. There's no capability to be innovative or to deliver excellence. It just gets washed out. It's like stonewashed jeans. They've got no personality left afterwards. You're just faded and thin and feeling tedious. And you're just almost, by the time you get to execute on the project, there's nothing, you know, you're just following the script that's been written. And the script was sort of written continuously. Yeah, no, not really. And I think the thing that I struggle with is that the bulk of the managers that I've had the pleasure of working with, if you want to call it that, is that they've largely just been secretarial positions. They have very little actual control or authority to take things in any particular direction. And their job really was to tick boxes and raise purchase orders and hold meetings. And that's not inspirational. That's just staff.
Not necessarily a fault of the person in the position, more a fault of the organization that structured it that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess it's also the process, right? A lot of the times in these big companies, and I've often worked for larger companies and smaller companies. Smaller companies are always great because you can just go and do something. So, you know, we're going to do the cutover on the weekend. Okay. So everybody comes in on the weekend and we do the cutover. But if you've worked for a company where there's like 20 network engineers and 50 server guys and you're going to do a cutover and it has to go through meeting after meeting after meeting, the life goes out of it. The ability to make a difference and to feel like you've really done something of value just gets faded away. And I think that's part of the IT that's missing is that challenge and response. You know, 20 years ago, I could go into an office on a weekend and rip out everything and replace, you know, Novell NetWare 2.0 servers and upgrade them to NetWare 2.15 and migrate all the data back. And it would just be awesome because it'd be so much faster on the Monday and everybody was excited. Upgrade from WordPress 5.0 to 5.1 and everybody could see the difference. And these days it's like, yeah, do a little bit of this, do a little bit of that, change this, add a route. You know, you haven't really shifted the dial. You've gone from like 99 to 100. You haven't gone from 0 to 50, if you know what I mean.
Yep, I do.
So, and so much of work these days is just secretarial tasks, you know, write a design for that people will ignore and not do anything with, you know, prepare a bill of materials that the reseller will get wrong when they put a quote together. Or the salesman will take it away and do something completely different because he wants to sell you a different product because it makes him more commission. You know, there's so many frustrations that I remember, which I remember much more clearly than the successes, which is probably the saddest thing to admit.
Ever. I was just thinking this, sad packet pushers are sad. Amy, I'll throw it back to you. Now that you've been a manager, do you better empathize with other managers?
Absolutely. I did. I mean, I've always been a pretty responsible, see, I'm a prepping employee. I always come to work on time and have a good attitude. There are so many employees that don't. And that's a hard concept for me because I've grew up with the work ethic. You show up for work. Yeah. You know, whatever's going on in your personal life, you put that aside and you come to work and you do the job and you have a good attitude about it. As managers, I wish every employee was that way. And they're not. And when other managers are having to deal with them, like I remember being on teams with people who were just like, these employees are just being jerks and they're not doing what they need to do. Why doesn't the manager just fire them, right? Just take care of this problem.
Oh,
right?
If it were only so simple.
I know. Now I'm like, oh my gosh, I know exactly why they never fire that person. Here's why, you know, and it's the same thing. I mean, there's always so much going on behind the scenes that a manager just can't tell the team. They can't explain another employee's personal situation. So yeah, I empathize with them. I sympathize with them, all of those things.
I always found it very difficult to identify with people's personal situations. What I mean by that is a lot of people would have personal lives that to me looked like they were a train crash. Let's not get into details, but you know, the sort of person, I think everybody's nodding their head, you know, somebody's
I am actually nodding my head, yes.
And you're sitting there trying to judge them and their fitness for work and is there anything you can do to help? And then on one hand, you're saying, you know, what can I do, you know, as a person, as a professional, what can I do to provide them with assistance and support? And on the other hand, at a personal level, you're going like, oh my God, what a mess. You are a walking personal disaster area. it's like,
things HR will not let you say.
Yeah. HR Cat will be on his way to chat to you shortly.
Exactly. No, you do have to have this professional level of even if the employee is spinning out of control and you just want to go, stop, get yourself together. You can't do that. You have to find a professional way to handle the situation. And it is a struggle. I mean, it's actually, like I said, it's this trying to evaluate an employee and understand how they work so that you can be effective for them, because you can't just beat them with a sparkly bat. It is frowned upon. So you have to find constructive ways in which HR will not call you into their office when you've
done it. You do understand some of the people from the 18th century when they did things like that, though. You do. Sometimes I do think, there was something to that.
Well, Amy, this is a good segue into, tell us a story of your biggest screw up as a manager.
Okay, you really are going to laugh about this, but my biggest screw up, or one of my biggest screw ups, because I've had some, I have many, is that actually I had this thought that I would have less meetings, which sounds awesome, right?
No. Stop right there. That can't be bad. It can't be.
That's what I thought too. I had this weekly meeting and I'm thinking, why? No, we don't need to have this. An email will do, right? And so then canceled the weekly meetings, and my team and their personality types, they valued FaceTime with me. And so when I canceled these meetings, they interpreted it as the boss didn't have time for them. I was, honestly, I did not see that coming. I was really surprised. And so I'm talking to another engineer about this, another manager who had been an engineer, and he put me onto this podcast. It's the Manager's Tools podcast. We should link to this in the show notes if we can. And the first two episodes are actually talking about the importance of one-on-one meetings with your employees. So not only putting back my weekly meeting, but having more meetings. I'm like, no, more meetings? Are you kidding? But I did. I started having these one-on-one meetings, and it built the team rapport just like they said they would. It's almost as if they knew what they were talking about. Yeah, I learned so much from that experience. Here I am thinking that I'm doing them a favor, right? Less meetings. And they responded in such a way that they were like, no, what are you doing? This isn't okay.
Extroverts. What are you going to do with them?
Exactly. So that was just such an eye-opening case of not reading my
It's baffling when that happens, because you often get no feedback because you're the boss. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, oh, hang on. Well, why didn't you just say, oh, gee whiz, people, come on. You know, act your age instead of your shoe size. Oh, did I say that? HR cat. Don't be talking about HR cat.
Oh, and that was the thing. It wasn't in my field of vision that someone would respond that way. It really wasn't. But team morale like dropped instantly. And it's like, what's going on? And it was really important. So I put back the weekly team meeting and I do these one-on-ones. And I don't have the same makeup of the same team all the time. But even the introverts don't mind these one-on-one meetings. And it works for me.
Now, when you put the meetings back, obviously people knew there was a policy change, and then you changed the policy back. So obviously you changed your mind, made a mistake, however you want to look at it. Did mm-hmm. you fall on your sword? How did you present that to the team to try to make it a little less awkward?
You know what? I'm a big proponent of just own your mistakes. I am. Like, you know what? I made a mistake, and this is important. What I have tried to do, so one of the reasons I stopped doing the weekly meetings was because I didn't feel like people were getting everything they wanted out of them. I wasn't getting what I wanted out of them. So instead, we just retooled the meeting. And it's more, what do you want to get out of it? And maybe it is just a 30-minute shoot the breeze, and that's the goal for them. Or maybe I need this. I need to get these updates, and this is how I will do it via a different vehicle. But we just talked about it, and you just own it. And I think as a manager, if you are willing to just own it and say, you know what, it was a mistake. I shouldn't have said this thing. I shouldn't have done this thing. I should have come to you about this. I didn't handle this right. I think you earn the respect of your team.
That's the secret to not being a bad manager. A good manager is somebody who has specific talents for communication and empathy and tracking all of the things that need to be tracked. But you can just be an okay manager just by admitting to your mistakes. And I think, I know that's a bit of a confusing concept, but as long as you can go back to them and say, this is wrong, I did it wrong, my decision was wrong, you'll never be a bad manager, in my view. The root of all the bad managers I've ever had is the people who didn't admit they'd made a mistake, or didn't admit that something was wrong, or didn't admit that a strategy wasn't working. Or
those people, Greg, that you're describing right there, in my experience, I've run into those people too. They tend to be the people that are going to throw their people under the bus and or take credit away from them to make themselves look good. You know, very self-centered kind of managers, frustrating to deal with.
They can be. Sometimes it can be a blind spot too. So it's not necessarily a personal aggrandizement that, you know, that their ego. They believe that they've done all the research and the vision can't be changed, and or that a decision once made can't be changed. There's many reasons why people don't do those things. It could even be like one person I was, you know, seething about. Turns out that he and his wife were having marital difficulties and he just wasn't functioning. And it can actually be just really simple things.
You know? And some people just suck.
An awful lot of them, to be But as a person, like at a personal level, like when I was a team leader, I'm sure I did lots of things to offend these people, because ultimately you have to make a decision and you're going to offside somebody. You have to make a choice one way or the other, or make no choice at all. And there are three possible decisions in, you know, that you have to make in any given situation. And some of them are right and some of them are wrong, and some of them are always going to upset somebody. The best decision is when it upsets. The best compromise is one that where everybody's unhappy.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I have learned that being a manager is so much about the employee's perception of you. Whether you mean to create this perception or not, it really is about how they perceive you. And if you've got an employee that acts mostly on how you make them feel, which is not the way that I behave, you have to really step up, and they have to feel that you are being loyal to them and that you are respecting them. And if they don't feel that, if they don't have that perception of you, it's almost impossible to run the team effectively.
Loyalty is a big one. Yeah. You want to know your manager's got your back for sure. Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, let's flip the tables back to the engineers, Amy, and give them some advice. How can an engineer perform better for their managers?
I think that being honest with your manager, as cliche as that is really the best thing you can do. I have actually had cases where, you know, you ask an employee, how can I be a better manager? What can I do? What don't you like? What would you like to see? And the answer is like, yeah, things are great. And then you find out later, not so great. I'm like, if your manager is asking you, tell them, don't worry about rocking the boat or hurting their feelings. You know, they're the only ones who have the power to fix it in many of these cases. So why wouldn't you tell them?
Because there might be repercussions, because I'm scared.
Well, there's a chance you have a pointy-haired boss who is just going to retaliate. Shouldn't you be looking for another job at that point anyways? I mean, you pretty much know if you have that kind of boss, right?
Never underestimate the power of looking for another job.
Really. Always have a plan B.
Always have a plan B and always be looking at the door and moving on. Really, the biggest mistakes I've made in my career over the years were sticking with bad managers or sticking with a bad company. It was the worst mistake. It made me unhappy and the people around me unhappy. And leaving those companies and moving on. Now, I might have moved somewhere worse, but at least I was in control of the situation. Do you know what I mean? And I have done that, you know, left a bad job and gone to another one just as bad. But at least I felt I was doing something about moving on instead of sitting there and stewing and making your life miserable.
My two cents on how an engineer can perform better for their managers is just be reliable. Be what you're supposed to be. Do what you say you're going to do. You know, if you say you're going to have the project done by such and such a date and you're going to let the manager know if there's an issue, do that, because then the manager assumes that that's what's happening. You know, and then comes the date and the project's not done. What happened? Oh, you know, this happened and the supplier called and said they can't deliver, you know, and on and on and on. You got to be reliable. You got to be someone that can be counted upon. That person is harder to come by than you'd think. And if you're that person, the manager is going to love you. That reliability and trustworthiness is a really big deal. You know, so keep up with your manager, do what you say you're going to do, and that'll take you a long way. Amy, should an engineer seek to be a manager?
The standard networking answer. It depends, right? Honestly, I love my job. I am both engineer and manager, and it's the right balance for me. I don't know if I would be as happy if I were just manager. I don't have to make that decision today, right? I get to be both. But it's not for everyone. So if you are thinking you want to be a manager, but you're somebody who gets frustrated and angry quickly when people don't act logically, management might not be the right career for you. I like to say employees will do awesome things and they will do stupid things. They will also do awesomely stupid things. And you can't let this eat at you. You can't let it get to you. But if you are someone who likes to invest in others, you like this mentoring, you have patience to deal with setbacks, then I think you would make a good manager. I really do. I think that a lot of managers are scared that managing is not an intellectual challenge, that it's just babysitting. And it's not true. I think when you build that strong team, it doesn't feel anything like babysitting.
You know, for me, it would depend a lot on the role and what you really are looking for. You know, I've been a manager in three different roles of significance. And then the last time I had an opportunity to be a manager again, I turned it down. I just didn't really want it. I was happy to be an engineer, an architect. I wasn't really looking for that management role. But that came with the experience of having done it in other roles and knowing I'm happy just to be, you know, the tech lead guy with no human being responsibilities, if you will, tied to that, because it did add an additional layer of stress that I wasn't really looking for. I could do my job and be happy without that. So that came much later in my career, actually, because early on, I thought I wanted to be a manager all the time. You know, that was like a, you know, a really big deal. And Amy, I completely agree. If you can't deal with people being people, then you don't want to be a manager. You want to be an engineer where you can stay off to the side and not damage them when things go badly. Because exactly. If you're a manager and you go off on someone, you can really screw things up bad. And you really will be talking to HR Cat. It can get nasty.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think one of the greater frustrations, and just to sort of caveat something here, I've worked in companies where the salary for engineers was capped at a certain level. And it could never be more than a manager was. In other words, the company said that managers were always worth more than any employee. The only way to earn more money inside of that company was to be a manager. And I watched a number of engineers take the management roles and actually go into a really, it was clear that they felt they wanted the extra revenue, they wanted the recognition, but they became very unhappy and had a very difficult time adapting. And in the end, most of them left.
Dude, I had that experience, exactly that experience. The only way I could get more money was to take on a management role. And so, you know, a role was created for me and another guy so that we could do that, so we could get more money. And then we moved into that formal management role with all of the secretarial work that went along with it, plus our technical leadership responsibilities. And we were both unhappy, despite the extra money. So you really do need to know what you're getting into and what the role is before you take it, because the money will not fix everything. Oh, if I get paid enough, it'll be worth it all. No, it won't. It really won't. It'll be fine for a bit. You'll be able to logic yourself through, yep, I get paid more, so this is okay. And then after a while, that pep talk you give yourself, it just quits working and you're frustrated and upset and you leave eventually. You just, because it's the only way out, you got to go.
That was when one of the times it really enforced to me the best way to get ahead is to leave, is to move on. You know, have one eye on the door as well as one eye on the desk where you are. And that makes good sense to me.
So, Amy, let's say you're an engineer and you really do think you would do well as a manager. That appeals to you. You've got the right people skills and you think you're getting into it for the right reasons. How would you prepare as an engineer to be a manager?
No, I would talk to other managers. I would specifically talk to not just your own manager, but to managers that aren't tied to your company or your business, because they'll be a lot more open, right? Your manager is going to be limited in what they can say about what they experience, but other managers in different companies, and maybe in different disciplines too. I mean, not all management is the same, right? There's different types of managers and different types of that you're supervising, different responsibilities. So I would actually just talk to them and see what their day looks like and ask them the type of questions we're asking on this podcast. You know, what's your worst day? What's the thing you like? you know, make sure that they're not just telling you, you know, hey, yeah, it's great. It's wonderful. If they're telling you everything's great and wonderful, they're probably a terrible manager. So you probably shouldn't talk to them.
You want to hear the stories. Well, this one time I hit him with a sparkly bat and he died. It was awful.
Exactly.
You want to hear those stories.
You're not supposed to know that story.
But sparkly bats don't kill.
No, they maim.
In a good way.
In a good way. They're helpful. Mentoring tools. The other thing, I mentioned it earlier, and these guys aren't paying me to say this, but the Manager's Tool podcast, you can find that online. Yeah, that's good stuff. Listen to it. They have some really good advice. I wish I'd listened to it before I started being a manager, but I was a little late to the show. But definitely some podcasts are out there. There's some good books. Read books on leadership. I still like the 7 Habits book, which you guys probably read or heard about. It's not necessarily management focused, but it's leadership focused. And a lot of those principles are very much the same. The other thing I would suggest is look into personality types. Do some research on personality types and find out what your personality type is. You may know, you may be so self-aware that you understand how you work. Some people don't, but understand how other people see the world.
Let me just express some caution there. Understanding personality types isn't a science like technology, but what it does do is it gets you thinking about personalities.
And Greg, then you're exactly right.
Yeah. So don't sit there and write notes to yourself. This person is this type of personality. This person's, I'm trying to think of the different personality modes that they have. Just sit down and say, you know, I'm looking for qualities about, and it just gives you insights and builds your empathy for people rather than being didactic and saying, box one, box two, this person is fits in this box and I'll treat them like that.
Yeah. People don't fit in boxes. Not physically, literally don't fit in boxes. And also, you know,
well, Bob will fit in a box if you cram hard enough.
Exactly. I've tried. but yeah, I'm actually familiar with the DISC study, but there's some other ones. And people aren't one personality or another. Everyone is this mix of things. I mean, there's very few people who are actually just one personality type, and you probably won't have them on your team. You'll have a mix of personalities. But understanding that people think differently than you do, I mean, it sounds obvious, but when you start looking at it, like my big meeting mistake, I never thought that anyone would interpret it that way. But if I had looked at the personality types I had, absolutely, I would have seen that coming.
So last question here before we close up the show, Amy. What can an engineer do to demonstrate that they are ready for a management role?
I think you just start by taking ownership of projects. Start taking leadership roles that are out there. Don't wait to be asked necessarily. Just volunteer for, hey, I really think this is interesting. I really want to lead this. And your manager is going to see that. And I really think as managers, we're always looking for someone who could fill in for us or take over that role if we were to move up or go somewhere. And it's okay to let your boss know that you're interested in that role. And they will typically, I mean, you might, again, have a pointy-haired boss who's just intimidated by you and won't help you. But in general, they'll mentor you and they'll see that. But speak up and make sure that when you're interacting with the team and other departments, know that people are watching and that says a lot about you and if you're ready.
Yeah, I agree with that. Then there's also the fear as a manager of, you know, that one person on the team that probably shouldn't be volunteering quite as much as they do, stepping up and saying, I'll do it. Oh, crap, not again.
Exactly.
Well, Amy Arnold, we've had a fun conversation about management and engineering versus management. Now, you're very social. How can people follow you?
I am on Twitter as Amy Engineer, and I have a blog that is much neglected, but it's still there. I still write occasionally, amyengineer.com, and those are probably the best ways to find me.
Yeah, my blog is embarrassingly neglected because I keep writing in all these other places. Anyway, Ethan Banks, at EC Banks on Twitter, ethancbanks.com is my neglected blog. Although you can go there and subscribe to my newsletter called The Hot Aisle, which I've been writing more in there than I have been blogging. And you can also find my writing on peccapushers.net, and occasionally I'll pop up on Network World and Tech Target and other places like that. Greg, what about you?
You can find me on my blog at ethereum1.com and on the social media as Greg Farrow in various places, Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for listening to Packet Pushers today. Demonstrate how amazing you are by telling your boss what you learned today on the show. You can find this and many more free technical podcasts for engineers along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.